CataractClub.com podcast series, episode number 179, Dr. Filomena Ribeiro, a visionary leader in ophthalmology who's a professor, a surgeon, an engineer, and the recent ESCRS president.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I've got a very special guest, and that is Professor Filomena Ribeiro from Portugal. You know her as the president of the ESCRS and a really keen researcher, but also engineer. So welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here. I'm a huge fan of your panel.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm a huge fan of all the things you've done with the ESCRS, and we'll certainly talk about that. But the first thing I mentioned earlier in the introduction is that, yeah, you actually have a PhD in biomedical engineering. So you have an engineer's mind. Tell me about the PhD and why you did that.
Isn't that crazy? Really was a little bit crazy. So this program that they start in the Lisbon University, I was the first to apply, and still I think I was the only one to finish it. It's too heavy, too difficult. But at that time, what really moved me, I think to complement our clinical practice, we need also to get together with some research and some educational field. So everything complements our clinical activity, right? So at that time, I was really, really puzzled with the IOL power calculation and the guys, you know? And yeah, so I thought physics can explain all of this. We don't see any kind of manufacturer of a telescopic lenses doing formulas to achieve the best result. So we need to start to consider that there could be another options to do the evaluation. And for that, of course, I would need some maths, physics, computation, and the PhD provide that to me. So it was quite a challenge, but I learned a lot.
Yeah, I mean, everything we do is certainly optics. And so optics is physics. We should be able to just apply the math and come up with an exact answer, right?
Well, I must say, it's not only about optics. Then we need to understand that after optics, we have a perceptual image. So something that we still don't know very much about it, but we know some phenomena that specifically our eye as an optical instrument works, and we can apply that to softwares like ray tracing that can simulate all these phenomena. And we can start to also learn a little bit more about how to improve the retina image, but also the perceptual image, which is the final goal, right?
Of course. Obviously, ultimately, it's a patient perception. I also like that you have an idea of a personalized pseudophakic eye model. So that's what we talked about, a little bit of ray tracing, right?
Yeah, so that was the purpose, to have a personalized model to fit the software ray tracing, which can allow us to simulate everything, including phenomena like the pupil, like the eyescrofer effect that we can simulate with the detection of the pupil. Everything, the sensitivity of different frequencies, for instance. So all this stuff we can simulate if we have a proper pseudophakic eye model that allowed us, of course, knowing the exact parameters of the IOL, which is kind of difficult. As you know, the manufacturers don't release this information. And it's a pity, because with this kind of approach, we can learn a lot about the performance also of the different intraocular lenses.
Right, it's kind of too bad. You're correct that the manufacturers now are not giving us the exact optics of the lens. And so we want that as we are engineers at heart. I want to know, what's the optics? How does this work? And they don't tell you.
Yeah, exactly. So they defend themselves, of course, of other companies. I can understand that. But we need to push a little bit more. And one of the proposals that I made to the industry already is, at least try to provide us for each IOL like a black box, that we cannot know what is inside, but we can try in a software like ray tracing. That would be amazing, and is not impossible. So us as a doctors, as a societies, we need to push a little bit more on this regard with the industry.
Right. I've had issues in my own clinic where certain lenses, like a monofocal plus or an EDOF lens, where there's a central 2 or 3 millimeter zone of increased power or curvature, and then patients have small pupils, and next thing you know, you aim for emmetropia, and they end up myopic. And we're not taking into account pupil size. Your ray tracing will, which is smart. But again, we have to know from the manufacturers, what are the optical properties of this lens? Don't just tell me the range where the patient see well. I want to know, how does the lens work?
Exactly. So still a lot to know. But at least if we, and the ECRS just recently made this huge job to make a totally new classification of the different options that we have right now, at least to provide us a clear idea, evidence-based, of course, what are the outcomes that we are providing to our patients. But of course, then at the end, we will need to couple, of course, this with some feedback from the patients, how they perform in their life, how they can manage quality of vision and also quality of life with these kind of solutions. And things like pupil saturation, still a lot of that we still need to learn how managing the
right. All these things are important. I also like some of your innovations in how do you analyze the cornea. So how do you analyze the total corneal astigmatism, the LED color topography, also your vector analysis of the surgically induced astigmatism. Tell me more about how you're evaluating the cornea too.
Oil power calculation for me is quite a challenge, and I love it. And correcting astigmatism right now is available for all of us in cataract surgery. So we need to still redefine some small issues. But at that moment, when we made these studies, we were starting to learn how to measure the posterior curvature of the cornea. And that was a big step. But of course, we need to understand how to use this information to improve our outcomes. And at that moment, what we found was that still provides better outcomes, estimate the total corneal power, compare with measuring, really measuring the true surface, and take in account for the total corneal power. I believe that will help also for us to improve on the devices and how they measure the posterior surface, that still probably there is some error. But at least we have a perfect view that what we have right now as ability to estimate the total corneal power is very useful, very good, provide good results for average corneas. If we have more extreme eyes, maybe we need to really consider to really measure and try to use real measurement data to do the calculation. But it's a great opportunity. Cataract surgery is a great opportunity to treat astigmatism, and we should face it always.
Yeah, especially when you have like a post-refractive eye, whereas LASIK or PRK, will change the anterior surface, but not so much the posterior. Things like radial keratotomy will change both the anterior and the posterior corneal curvature. And that makes it more complicated.
Exactly. So that's why we still need to understand a little bit better the measurements that we do in the cornea. Not only this issue of the relation between the anterior curvature and the posterior curvature, but also how to measure these eyes that have some corneal surgery. Still, we can improve on these cases, although there are a lot of difference between what were the first treatments that appeared at that time. We had very small optical centers on the cornea and a lot of aberration. So right now, things also have changed on the normograms for treating the cornea. And the results right now are a lot better because of that also.
I also like your idea of tailoring it to where the patient uses the vision. If you have someone who's tall, 185 centimeters, they often read things further away from their face, maybe 40, 50 centimeters away. Whereas you have a very short person who's 135 centimeters tall, that person may hold things very close, like 30 centimeters. And so you have this idea of a wearable sensor. Tell me about the sensor that the patients wear.
Yes, that was quite a nice study. At the time, we were starting with the working group on functional vision on ECRS. And something that we still don't have a truly definition is what is functional vision, right?
Right.
So, yeah, well, as doctors, we are used to measure far distance vision, near vision, but what about the else, the intermediate vision that we use every day on our tasks? So what we have done is was in a population for cataract surgery. They used in the spectacles a device that for 3 days measure all the distance that they used all over the day. And it's quite amazing, not only the results, but also the ability to show to the patient, because sometimes we start to talk about intermediate vision, near vision, and they, what do you mean, right? What this translate on? And having these graphs to show the patient also is some educational way to say to them what they can win or what they can lose.
Right.
But at that time, the results were quite interesting because altogether, the near and the intermediate vision seems to be more used in daily basis compared right. with far vision. So it's something for us as cataract surgeons to pay attention and start to define what is the value to correct this. Because we
right.
don't have that. And we need that to talk with our patients, but also with the regulators, with the governments, something that is upon us to define the correct value that we are providing with this
right. implant. Yeah, in your study, in your paper, I think patients who wore the wearable sensors to measure exactly how they use their eyes for 3 days, 72% of their required vision was near and intermediate, and only 28% was distance. But yet in our clinic, what are we always checking? Snellen visual acuity at 6 meters. Why?
Yeah, that's it. So we need to test more, and the visual acuity is only tested by us in a small feature which is recognized Snellen letters.
Right. At 6 meters.
Doesn't say too much about quality of vision, and that is the way that we need to pursue for the future. Try to find quality of vision, good collecting good data about that, and how in an easy way to test it and evaluate it.
Right, for sure. I mean, me personally, I'm minus two. And so I love it because I'm obviously presbyopic. And I have relatively small pupils. So at my distance, maybe it's 6'12", 6'18", good enough. But my near vision is just fantastic. And like your study showed, I probably spend 80, 90% of my day doing intermediate and near work. And so it's just amazing.
Exactly. And another amazing result, at least for me, was kind of surprising, was that the most part of the activity in near and the intermediate vision is done on mesopic conditions.
Mm.
That is also something that we need to integrate and consider when choosing the right optical design to fit the purpose of for the person.
Right, because we test it usually with bright lights.
Exactly.
And they're using it in more mesopic conditions.
So that's why all these different elements, and you mentioned the guy with the big arm.
Sure.
But also you mentioned the myopes. They have a very good near vision and very near. The hyperopes that always use correction, they also are used to some kind of amplification of the near vision. Right. So all these details makes the need to pursue the possibility to have a really personalized way to choose the best option for our patient. And that, that is something that the model that we mentioned, the ray tracing software, could be a good way to advance on this field.
I think so too. I think if you incorporate how the patient uses their eyes, what their needs are, and then also the thing we always forget, we do these lens calculations, we look at the cornea, look at the AC depth, look at the axial length, we never take into account the pupil size.
Yeah.
And that's so, so, so important, but we don't do it.
Exactly. And or we don't have the conditions to do it properly. So, yeah, because the other problem that we have considering this kind of features is the way we report on the papers that we publish. So we need to start to really standardize the way we report the results to bring us data that is performing the same way with the same protocol, and to provide insights.
For sure. I think the paper that you were helped with the ESRS simultaneous vision classification for the IOLs, that's so important because now it's going to standardize it, and all worldwide ASCRS agrees, and it's like a joint paper for worldwide. Let's all classify lenses this way. Then we can actually compare them side by side.
Exactly. It's the only way. So what really matters to us is the outcomes in the patient. So where should we go to find criteria to classify these IOLs to the outcomes of the patients? So right. It's kind of natural. We need to look in the outcomes and seeing what an IOL can provide as a visual performance. With standardized ways to do it, it's perfectly clear how we compare different optical technologies.
For sure. I think there's been a shift even in my practice where I could try to compare the trifocal lenses, which is a full range, to an EDOF or extended depth of focus, which is not quite full range. But in my own practice, I find myself doing more EDOF lenses than trifocal now. How do you, you obviously use both. How do you choose which patient is best for each lens?
Well, I think my approach is always try to give the best for the patient, right?
Right.
So first condition, try an approach top to down. So to have the more complex optical design, we all know that the eye needs to be totally healthy. So this is a precondition, very important. And the second is that the patient needs to understand the trade-off of some visual quality compared with the fact that it really has a good quality of life with independence of classes. But they need to understand this. They need.
Right, right.
So what I think the extent, the partial intraocular lenses and the extent can provide right now is address more patients. Right. Because we can be a little bit more, they are more tolerant for a small residual refractive error, for instance. So if we are worried about some biometric value that really is not the expected one on this patient, or we are somehow afraid of some incorrections for the IOL power calculation, is a very good solution. People with some issues like lacrimal film or diseases that provides a low contrast sensitivity. Well, if we intend to provide a little bit more, is better. If not, it's not a such complex design, because we know that the trade-off is also to lose some contrast sensitivity.
So sure.
What I think is opens a window for giving also possibility to correct as much as we can the functional vision of our patients and increase the number of people that we can enroll.
Yeah. Right, right, right. So yeah, that's great for patient selection and the lens power and the lens selection. But you also had a really big push recently for the ESCRS to increase the surgical simulation training labs, which I think is so helpful. It is such a popular feature of ESCRS. Tell me more about the labs, the wet labs.
Yeah, so education also is, as I said, a field of my heart. And we live in a European society with different countries and different rules and different ways to do training or not. So after assessing our membership, we understood that some countries, some people, some trainees, they have truly difficulties to start to build the surgical training. That is one part. The other part is that right now we have so good ways to do simulated surgery, that we need to push on this in order to not be so dependent on the learning curve on the patients. They are really efficient, is already proved, and all people should start like that before going to human eye. So as a European society, I thought that it should be a main goal, a main target for the society to provide ways for people to have a sense of training, surgical training. And that is the old goal for this.
Right. In certain countries like US or in Portugal, the residents do a lot of surgery and they get a great hands-on experience. But there are other countries where the residents may do the whole 4 years, 5 years of ophthalmology residency and do very few or even zero cataract surgeries.
Yes.
And so that's why your labs are so popular. There are people from dozens of countries who come just for the labs.
Exactly. We need to face that. And we need to face that in a world that we know that we have demographic changes. And so we'll have a lot more cataract surgery to do in the near future. So we need to prepare our future surgeons and give them the best conditions to start the training if they want.
That's, I think, is a great idea. So, and one of the things that was popular for me to teach in a wet lab recently was how to do an IOL exchange.
Yes.
Because I think more and more we're doing, if we don't set good patient expectations, we have more unhappy patients with a, let's say, trifocal lens, and we end up doing more IOL exchange.
Yes. As we say, everything that we implant, you need first to learn how to explant it. Right. So that is a rule. Yes, but at your point, it's not only about the basic training. It's also about complex cataract training.
Sure.
And we can use these beautiful artificial eyes, digital instruments that right now provide us the ability to try out, to make some training before real surgery on a complex cataract case, if you are not a person that only deals with this complex cataract, you can improve and learn a lot with these training lawyers. Yeah.
Yes, for sure. Important to learn it first time in the wet lab with the model eye. You don't want to try it for the first time in the human eye and be surprised.
Exactly. But right now also we have such a huge developments on the ability how to train. I'm thinking, we are thinking now to build up this project and try to do it in an annual basis and with mentorship, because right now it's very easy to provide mentorship for the transition between simulate training to real cases, even being at distance. So it's something that are developing also AI with all the evaluation of the surgical videos that can provide insights, and it's also a big source of learning. So there are a lot to do on the training and the education field in ophthalmology. Yeah.
I think the AI will begin to take a bigger and bigger role recently, because I have 3,000 videos for Cataract Coach on YouTube. YouTube is owned by Google. So now Google Gemini has been actually getting the transcripts from my videos and using those as information for the AI. So now I can ask very specific questions and it gives a pretty good answer. And I say, what's the source for this? And it shows all these YouTube videos.
Wow, you need to be proud. Of course, you are a big, that doesn't fret us. Yes. So you have a big educational instrument also. It's very good. And it's good that the artificial intelligence make the clear reference where it provides this information to give to the person. And if he's reliable, we are happy.
Right. Well, on YouTube also, my account, I have verified that they verified my medical license.
Oh,
I'm actually a physician. So on my YouTube account, it says from a verified physician.
Wow. Yeah. We are facing a new world. We need to be prepared.
Right.
I think artificial intelligence will be great instruments for us, and it will make our task a lot better. But we need to start now to understand how it works.
Right.
And understand how to make the evaluation of what is offering us. Because what we don't want is to end up in black boxes that we don't understand what is there, because it doesn't give any learning on this process. So that are the challenge that we have with artificial intelligence.
For sure. It's still evolving. It'll take time.
Yeah.
Now, you also, besides, you do a lot of surgery, you do a lot of work with leadership at ESRS, you do a lot with the engineering background, but you also publish so many papers. Wow. I'm amazed. Tell me about all your research and your publications and how you keep so busy.
Well, yes, as I said on the very beginning, I think we have a little bit more holistic view of our profession value. And I think coupled with the clinical practice with research and education is fundamental for the evolution. Not only be a technician of some kind of surgery or speciality. So it's something that I push, I love also. And yeah, that's motivation.
And I also notice now a lot of studies have, of course, the data we measure in the clinic and with the instruments, but they also have, they now incorporate patient-reported outcome measures in the same trial, which I think is very unusual. We didn't have that as commonly 10 years ago.
Yes, but it's a big change. And it's something that, for instance, is kind of a goal for the European Commission. Everything being based in prompts, which is good because at the end, what we intend to know if we are going to provide or not good quality of life for our patients. And so even because we have this change, demographic change, we have more people, elderly people, but it's good to live more, but if it's with quality, right? So right. We need to assess all these to have big answers for big questions in medicine.
You're right, and also big data. So we can crowdsource group data now.
Exactly, in a very easy way. So it really is a new instruments with the ability to improve a lot our research field.
Right, because if you look at some unusual eyes, let's say like 37 millimeter axial length, very, very myopic. In my own clinic, I may only have a few patients like this. But then I get your clinic and everyone else's clinic, and you put all the data together, all of a sudden now you have 500 or 1,000 eyes of a 37 millimeter axial length. Now you can analyze this in a cohesive way.
Exactly, and that is something very, very relevant for something that we also need to consider, which is equity in health system. So we cannot only develop and progress on solutions for the average cases. We need to expand and see also other populations. If this model fits to them also, or we need to rethink a new model for these more extreme populations or different type of populations. So big data, it will be a big solution for this also. So but we need to know how to use it properly to change also the one of the problems of the world right now, which is the access of the healthcare,
right,
in an equity way.
Right, access varies a lot depending on where you are, which country, which continent.
Exactly.
And so, like, you could be in a country like the U.S. where there are a lot of ophthalmologists for, let's say, every 100,000 for the population. Whereas you go to other places, there may be one ophthalmologist for 10 million people.
Exactly. So totally change the way how to perform and to give healthcare to this population.
Right. Tell me about some of your humanitarian work. I was reading that you do the Eyes of the World. I try to say it in Portuguese, but I'll say it wrong. Olhos del Mundo.
That is Catalan, not Portuguese.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In Portuguese would be Olhos do Mundo.
Oh, okay. I'm terrible.
Very difficult.
I can do Ojos del Mundo. I can do that.
Okay. That's easy. Okay. In Spanish.
Yeah, tell me about your project there and going to Mozambique and beyond.
Yeah, so that also was integrated on the charity program of ECRS. And it's a very good project in Mozambique that has received a grant of ECRS. And I was there to see the evolution, the development of the project, and it was really amazing. Also because it addresses the problem that we just mentioned before. This organization, the Eyes of the World, they suddenly understood that going in campaign, they provide more access to healthcare, but they increase the difference of access of healthcare between males and women. So offering more opportunities, only males can come. So the this balance between the healthcare access to women and the men's totally increase. So it's something that they were aware of it and they wanted to take care of it. And that so now they perform these missions, these campaigns in a totally different way and trying also to, it's very interesting, the whole movement around the small communities also, not only to give the proper access to different genders, but also for the community, the population to understand and help on this purpose.
Right.
It was quite an amazing experience.
Wow, sounds great. And there's a big change now. In the past, it was you would do a trip there, do the surgery for them, and then leave. And now it's different. You're going there to teach and train the local doctors. Let's show you how to do the surgery. And then you can be self-sustaining.
Yeah, exactly. That is the ultimately goal, of course. Not always is easy. There are different countries, different ways to approach right now how we can help. Not all African countries are prepared to have people to be trained and fix them on these countries to after receiving the training. Also is a challenge for the socio-economical reasons, of course. So different approach, but yes, the outstanding would be to teach how to fish, not to fish for them.
Correct. Absolutely. I also, our podcast, lots of young ophthalmologists listen in their 30s and 40s. And I really encourage them, if they've never done one of these trips, these missions, to definitely do it, because these are first some of the most difficult cases. They're all brunescent. They're all white cataracts. And the patients may have had light perception vision for years. And one of the most amazing things is post-op day number one, you take off the patch to see their face. Wow. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, well, I think we are fortunate to be ophthalmologists.
Right.
Because really, cataract surgery, and we are talking about cataract surgery, is really, I think, is the surgery with more success in all medicine.
Right.
Because it retrieves visual acuity. That is something really that improve a lot quality of vision, all lives.
Right.
So we all are kind of used to receive these big smiles after cataract surgery. But when we consider these people that they face really very difficult access to healthcare, and how this impacts on the conditions that they live is really even huge. So all young people, if they can go, I also encourage the young surgeons to go in a mission and to understand this what we really can provide to these people is amazing.
I totally agree. Some of the best times, I did many, many missions in my career. And especially when you're a younger surgeon in your 30s, it's a great experience. It makes you a better surgeon too.
Exactly. Yeah. And a better person. I can add that.
for absolutely, for sure. So tell us again, you do also some projects like this where you set up the camps, you're doing surgery, you're teaching them how to do surgery. But we may also notice that you have a charitable focus at the ESCRS to make units for refugee camps now, like in Greece, I saw that, and another community in Bangladesh. So it's not just one place, it's kind of worldwide now.
Yes, yes. So we have a charity committee. We are a charity. ECRS is a charity. So we have this focus. And we have a charity committee that every year makes several meetings and try to address where we can really make a difference, helping projects, good projects all over the world. So it's, of course, well focused on Africa, because is the continent with more needs. But now, in these times, the world is changing, and we need to consider another things that are happening around us. And we had a lot of projects, not only the ones that you mentioned, but also with Ukraine, for instance. You try to help in the best way we can, not only providing instruments and materials, but also education, and still access to distance education, but try to provide them all the needs to have a flow in different conditions, of course.
No, for sure. Another good initiative you've started as well, or being involved in, is the sustainability. Because right now, I know in Beverly Hills, when I do a cataract, one surgery creates a whole big bag of trash just for one cataract.
Yeah, exactly. So
the sustainability project, the BOSS one, which is Building Our Sustainable Inclusive Society, BOSS.
Exactly. This is a big, big project. As you know, Oliver, in his presidency, he pushed a lot on sustainability. And we developed good instruments like the CDs. So, for instance, if you want, you can pick your pack surgical pack, and assess with this instrument, which is the CDIX, is in the website of ECRS. You can assess what the waste you are producing.
Right.
And to make you reflect, do I really use all of these, or can I go to a pack that is more more friendly, thinking about carbon waste. So that was a big, big project. And I tried to build on that, not because we have different challenge right now on the world, and also as a community, scientific community. And that's why we thought about BOSS, Building Our Sustainable Society. Because it's not only about environment, it's also to develop a society, a community that really reflects the scientific values, and brings from people different perspectives, that they can ask different questions, and at the end we can have better decisions. So if we are more inclusive on the Congress, the membership, and try to integrate different ways, different needs. And that means to build our future society from now on. And it's a very big project.
Sure.
With all these targets, but I think it's very meaningful for the near future.
For sure. Yeah, you had so many different projects with ESCRS. The BOSS one was one project, but then also I really enjoyed, you did the 75th anniversary of the IOL with the IOL Experience Tunnel for Ridley's Legacy, which I thought was great. The mentoring cafes, which was a fantastic idea. And then even changing it from just a lecture to the arena format. The arena format was great.
Yeah.
Tell us about the arena format.
Yeah, well, we see things changing around us. So we should not stop with a model of Congress that, okay, is very successful, but we need to, in order to keep building our society, to introduce some innovation that makes the members be more active with us. And all these new models, they target that networking, sharing opinions, be relevant, sharing your opinion. So in a different way, in a different concept, but that is also a big learning moment and preparing also future leaders for the society. That as a society, we need this connection with our members in order to develop for the future. So these different specific models worth thought about them.
Right. You also have projects or initiatives to help give opportunities for underrepresented groups. There are more for female opportunities as well. You'll be surprised. This is at UCLA, where I used to be professor here in Los Angeles. There's 8 residents per year we take. Mm-hmm. This year, 8 out of 8 are female.
Yes, everything is changed. I see the same. Now I'm going to the Lisbon University to teach ophthalmology, and it's hard to find a man. It's hard to find a man. So, yes, and this is very relevant because it's something that we also need to consider. When we talk about gender balance, it's not only in a one way of view. We need to review the global picture. Right now, there are a lot more women under training. So we need to consider that we need to somehow prepare to help more women to have leadership roles. Sure. They need to be prepared to face that. That's one. The second is really what you mentioned. I think it's also not fair that the system how makes the selection for a medical college maybe is too wrong for males. So maybe we need to redefine. In Portugal, we had that problem. So we intend to be the most democratic way to make the selection, and that is by grades. That's it.
Yeah.
And it was, in my opinion, a very democratic way to do it. But what we are seeing now is that this has a reflect on the gender disbalance, which is something that we also need to try to reconsider what we can do more.
Yeah, there's no perfect way. There's no perfect answer.
No, not really.
But I think ophthalmology has become much more popular. In the USA, certainly, 25 years ago, it was not as competitive to get an ophthalmology match. 25 years ago, you probably had an 80% chance of matching into an ophthalmology residency. Now the number is probably 50%.
Oh, wow.
So it became a lot more competitive in the last 25 years.
That is different from Portugal. Always, every year, ophthalmology is the high one. Yes,
right.
Since I remember.
So here it's plastic surgery and dermatology and orthopedics. Those are probably the most competitive.
Okay, and dermatology also, no?
Yes, dermatology. And then especially in Los Angeles, plastic surgery, lots of plastic surgery.
Okay, yeah.
So what advice do you have here for a young ophthalmologist? Why is it important to, yes, learn surgery, yes, learn ophthalmology, but why do you have to also understand the physics of it, whether it's the phaco machine physics or it's the physics of the optics? Why is engineering such an important mindset for an ophthalmologist?
Well, I think, as we mentioned, the fundamentals of optics and also biomedical engineering is what allowed us to understand the physical concept of vision.
Mm.
And so to understand why some solution works or recognize limitations of a new solution or try to make innovation, we need to understand what we are doing with the technology. Ophthalmology is a very technological specialty, and we need to understand all these concepts to provide the best solution and the best decision-making process. So optics really and physics is part of our specialty, and we need to have insights on this regard.
For sure, for sure. Even when we're doing cataract surgery, even the fluidics of the phaco machine, the way you're delivering the ultrasound energy, you're using an excimer laser or femtosecond laser, you have to understand the physics.
Exactly. And the limitations of the principles that we are using. Yes, truly, truly. We are a very technological specialty. So biomedical engineering makes all the sense to have more interaction with ophthalmologists. So, but for that to happen in a value way, we need to get a little bit more insight about optics to provide the right answers.
Right, for sure. And even now we have some IOL manufacturers say, this lens gives a wider range, extended depth of focus, but the optical quality is the same as a monofocal. And then I say, wait a minute, stop. The number of photons entering your eye is the same. If I'm at nighttime or mesopic conditions, the amount of photons is the same. If I put all the photons with a monofocal lens at one range, that'll be great. But if I get those same photons and I spread them over a wide range, you're going to have less contrast. You can't cheat physics.
Yeah. No, we can't cheat the physics. But also we need to understand how the whole optical human system works with these photons. Okay? Mm. So we need to understand that also we have some limitations on the cone mosaic, on the photoreceptors distribution. Sure. That is a kind of limitation. We have not a totally centered optical system, another limitation. We have the ganglion cells that increase the contrast for us. So a lot of things that we need to still understand and optimize to really give the best best functional vision, because at the end is what it matters. You mentioned the difference between the far quality vision. Yes, is relevant for us if we perceive it at the point that we perceive it and change the way we behave.
Right.
Right? If doesn't is perceived by us or doesn't make a big change, so if we can improve a little bit the depth of field, it's even better. And right, we have good solutions right now, very good solutions, and improving.
Do you think we'll ever get a truly accommodating IOL with like five diopters of accommodation? Will it ever come?
Well, that is a path that we already saw that is difficult to go there, which is kind of amazing. With so many resources that we have now, we still cannot replace the crystalline lens, the natural crystalline lens is unbelievable. But yeah, I don't see that right now we are in a moment that we can say the accommodative IOLs, they will develop in a way that can be regular used. I don't see it.
Yeah, I'm hopeful.
Yeah,
I don't see it coming, but I wish it's ready in time for me.
Exactly.
But time will tell. Well, thank you for talking. It's been almost 1 hour we've been speaking.
Wow.
Amazing. I look forward to seeing you at the ESCRS coming up in London. That'll be so much fun. I love that meeting. In fact, I want to just congratulate you and your whole ESCRS team. That meeting has just grown every year. It's become incredible. I think it's the biggest ophthalmology meeting on the whole planet now, right?
Yes, it is. So very proud of that, but also with the responsibility to provide a good and very strong, meaningful scientific program.
Oh, for sure.
And the possibility for all of us to be together, to do our networking, to be with each other.
Right.
And that is also something very important for the Congress.
Right. And now we get so many international doctors. This last ESCRS in Copenhagen, there were like 500 Brazilians.
Right.
It was amazing. There were more Brazilians there than Americans. Well, I got to tell my USA colleagues, you need to go to this ESCRS meeting. It's that good. It's my favorite meeting the whole year. You have to start going. We need more Americans coming.
That is something that is maybe the core of what I was looking for on the leadership of the societies to go more broader, to spend, not because we need this interaction. Maybe Europe can provide more more ways to do a proper research, be prepared more on that, and giving guidelines as we have done for cataract and refractive surgery. But we need still to receive from other geographic points their needs, the creativity that sometimes our regulations in Europe does not allow us, and how everything can match to improve what we can offer to our patients.
Right, we can all learn together. I think that's amazing. Well, again, ESRS is amazing. You've done such great work there. It's really quite impressive.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So I look forward to seeing you soon. And yes. Thank you. I'll see you in London. We'll have a great time for sure.
We'll be there. Let's meet in London.
For sure. Thank you. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we have a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday. Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Everywhere you find a podcast, of course, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. And yes, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day, more than 3,000 days in a row, and we still got a new one tomorrow. So until next week, I'll catch you later.